Hello, I'm Russell Howard. This week on The Wonder Box, which, as you know, is where I'm talking to guests about things they adore, we've got one of Britain's best-loved radio DJs. He's recently taken the podcast world by storm with his new show, The Daily Grind. This is Sean Keaveney's Wonder Box. So I'm here with the fantastic Sean Keaveney. Nice to see you.
You as well.
You look like the kind of man that would be at home in a lighthouse.
Oh, what a great start.
Yeah. I mean,
you don't
I mean
know
that I, as a compliment.
I know you do.
Yeah.
I took it as a compliment immediately. I didn't have to think twice. Because you don't know how close you are to the essence of Keaveney there. Because number one, I love visiting lighthouses. And sometimes my wife gives me stress breaks every now and again because she can tell that I'm losing my mind. And she'll go, listen, but maybe twice, three times a year, just go off on your own for two nights. She's amazing.
Oh, wow.
And the last time I did it, I ended up at the top of Portland Lighthouse.
Wowzers.
It was wonderful. And also...
Any hostages or...?
No. I was tempted. There were a couple of annoying kids up there. Also, people say I look like Captain Haddock for some reason. Something about the beard, the guy from Tintin. But I think you might also be making reference to my jumper.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very cold day when we're recording this.
That's correct, yeah.
My mother-in-law, Kim, knitted this for me.
Oh, wowzers.
Yeah, she's an unbelievable knitter. And she could knit this building a jumper.
Did she measure you or took a guess?
I don't think she did, unless she surreptitiously did it.
I mean, yeah, Jason. You know, she's coming on to it. Ah, it's a jumper.
Yeah, no, I understand. It's the tape measure.
It's done all right, actually.
It's pretty.
And also, there's room to manoeuvre in it.
You know, that's what you need. You know, and on a very cold day, you need to remember that. You need to double up sometimes. Unfortunately, I forgot my long johns.
I tell you what's a tricky thing at the minute, because the weather, as you record this, -4.
God.
It's that tricky thing. Like, when you're outside, you've got your long johns, you've got your kind of Under Armour, as I've got. You've got your big coat. And then suddenly you're on the train and you're roasting.
Yeah.
It's about finding that in-betweeny where you can hack it outside so it's just right inside.
Yeah. You've got to get the balance. It's something that when you hit your 50s, it's one of the things that you get right. You're just getting it right. You're getting the layers right. You're getting the right jumper at the right, in the right occasion.
Mm.
You've got really good layer game, I think, when you hit your 50s. It's something you won't know about for quite some time, Russell.
That's interesting. So you can just look at the weather and you know what to select.
Honestly, yes. I think it's one of my great superpowers. You know, I don't have many. Anybody that knows me well knows I don't.
It's like a sort of a cozy Iron Man. Do you know what I mean? That it all kind of hits you at the right time.
You're going to regret that jacket in 2 hours' time. Yeah. Just saying. I'm not very good at anything, right?
Yeah.
Something that might reveal itself as time goes on in this conversation. I'm not just saying that in a disingenuous way. I've got very low level of skill sets. But guesstimates, guessing, estimating things, I'm amazing at it. It's just, I don't know what it is. I'm a great generalist, Russell.
That's
I'm a great generalist. No good with specifics.
Have you ever done the village fete, the sweets in the jar?
You know, why have I never done that? I'd be walking away with it.
Yeah.
This is the thing. They'd be kicking burning effigies off me around the village square.
You'd be led out of the village. Do you know what I mean? He's a fucking warlock, this guy.
Third year running? I'm sorry.
So when you cook, you're not looking at instructions. Nah.
That's for idiots, as far as I'm concerned. Just hurl it in. Unfortunately, that means that my cooking's virtually inedible.
Yeah.
But that's the way I do cook.
I like that. I'm the other way. I'm so non-confident in cooking, I have to follow it.
Okay.
So I'm looking, and I've got photos and...
220 grams of
caster
sugar.
Yeah, it's all that.
With bacon, you've got to be like that, obviously, because it's scientific, isn't it?
And my oven's tricksy at the minute. I've got to go 10 degrees hotter than it says.
You've got to ride it a bit, haven't you?
Again,
that's guesstimation, isn't it?
And I'm looking at it all the time, and I'm, you know what I mean? Christmas dinner was tricky this year. I was just constantly glaring.
You sort of did the Christmas dinner, did you? For how many?
I did it with my mother-in-law, Wendy, and my mum, Ninette, and we did it for, how many was there? It was 14 of us.
Bloody hell.
Yeah,
and you cooked?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know why I sounded so surprised then.
Oh, no, that's obvious. I remember Phil Jupiter saying that to me on Nevermind the Buzzcocks. There was a news story and I kind of knew about it and was chatting about it. And Phil Jupiter looked at me as if to go, you don't look like someone that knows stuff. And I was like, yeah, I know. I've got that fate. I look so vacant and so kind of, oh, that'll do. You know, I've sort of always had that face. So people are always surprised when I'm not just
That's interesting. Puts his trousers on as well. Remarkable skills.
That's exactly it. So let's get cracking. I'm excited about this.
I can't wait.
What is the first thing you'd like to put in your wonder box? What is it you adore, Sean?
Right. Okay. I mean, you know, can I just say at the start of this wonderful experience that I think it's a little bit like asking somebody, what's your favourite Beatles song, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whatever. It's like, it's just at that moment, that's what comes to mind. So it's not necessarily always, you know, the top five things.
This is a snapshot.
Snapshot at the moment. But I have said that my first electric guitar is a thing that I would love to secure for posterity, I think.
What does it mean to you?
Well, actually, that's a really good question, because it does mean something, doesn't it? I remember... Well, first of all, to answer that question very directly, I suppose it means a sort of opening of a door, psychologically, portal into a totally new destination of life, you know. Mm. So I was 15, same age my eldest kid is now, actually. And the very short story, because it's quite boring, is that we were supposed to be going on our second foreign holiday, Russell, right?
Mm. Where was the first?
It was Menorca, 1986, Dan Air.
So you'd done that, and you were looking forward to going to...
I think we were going to go to one of the other Balearics, right? But we had to not go at the last minute for all various boring reasons. But to make up for it, my mum and dad said, look, I know you've been playing your uncle's guitar, we'll buy you a guitar. So I went to the local Lee Music Centre, and there was this second-hand Westbury Standard guitar. You know, an unremarkable thing. But it represented this kind of this opening up of a whole new... I got completely obsessed with a guitar for a long time. And all the way up to being about 23, I was honestly convinced that I was going to be a successful musician. I thought I was going to be like fucking Dave Gilmour or something.
And were you in bands?
Yeah.
Names of bands?
Well, I mean...
A guitarist? Were you a singer?
Well, I mean, that's, a good question. I'm a quadruple threat. I can play everything. I mean, really, I'm like the prince of the Wigan Borough. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'm a bit taller.
Yeah.
Possibly not quite as talented. But we were in a lot of different bands. But the primary one that you would definitely have heard of was the very influential early 90s post-punk band Mosk.
Oh, yeah, I know Mosk.
Obviously. Yeah, now, said it.
Mm.
You're there, aren't you?
Yeah, the whole audience took their shoes off before they came in.
used to
do 5 gigs a day.
Facing the Mecca Bingo on Railway Road. Yeah. But that's it. It's a bit odd to talk about it now, because people think you're taking the piss because it's such a weird name for a band.
Mm.
I think it was because... my uncle Martin was in it. He's only 2 years older than me. It's a northern thing.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
2 years. Okay, it's fine. But until you say that, it's weird.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But you have to say the 2 years. Otherwise, my uncle Martin was in there. Fucking hell, no wonder you made it.
Exactly. What, he was 31 and you were 15. What was he doing with his life?
Yeah, exactly.
So it was Martin Ormrod, because we were rehearsing a pub called The Three Crowns. And there was a dartboard. We weren't getting much practice done. We were playing darts. Martin Ormrod on this side of the... on that side of the blackboard, SK, Sean Keevan on this side. We're like, oh, yeah, maybe Mosk. And then we changed it to the place of worship spelling. But of course, now when you talk about it, it sounds like some kind of political statement, when it's just not. It's just some stupid teenagers couldn't think of a name. But, you know, all the great songs, Lost Things, MASH 407, the punk song, which is all about MASH, the television programme.
Yeah.
Ferry Strike, a song about a ferry strike.
But it also, it's that thing of like when you were 15 when you got the guitar.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. It's that thing where you're suddenly like, right, this is my lightsaber. I can now go out and save the galaxy. But until you've got that thing, you've got no chance to be it. But presumably that moment when you first strum your guitar and you own her, that must just be incredible.
It was really exciting.
Yeah.
It was so exciting. And the weird thing about... you might have it about different things. You might have it about guitars, but when people get obsessed with a particular thing, so it might be cars for some people or whatever. It might be clothes for some people.
Watches. I remember spending an afternoon with Greg Davies
in
Montreal, and he took me around various watch shops. Means nothing to me, but it was exciting watching him get excited about watches. Do you know what I mean?
I'm a bit like that about watches as well. But if you talk to people who are into guitars... it's beyond a fetish and an obsession. It's a quasi-spiritual thing.
Yeah.
You can never, ever have enough guitars.
Yeah.
and you're constantly making excuses to your partner or whoever and saying, you don't need another one. It's like, you don't understand. Yeah. I really fucking do. And also, you become like a sort of bad trader. You know, you're always buying and selling, a bit like sort of like a sort of terrible Only Fools and Horses, you know what I mean? And I'm always losing a bit of money, but not loads, and trying to justify it. But you're absolutely right. It's a sort of homecoming thing. And I see it now with my kids. Whatever it is, and often it's comedy or something, isn't it? There's a sort of a key to the lock of what it is that's going to take you on, you know, because that's why I always say to the kids now, it's like, I'm not always all that worried about how well you do at school.
Yeah.
But if you're passionate about something,
yeah,
as long as you have a passion, that's what I'm really interested in, you know.
Yeah.
But it's hard until you find it, I think.
Did you ever have a gig that you still can hark back to?
Yeah.
When you were like, oh, we knocked out of the park that day.
We do. We've got a few of these. We do still do it. You know, oh, Miners Arms, 1990.
You remember it?
Yeah. Oh, it was just, you know, just to give you an idea of the kind of thing that was going on, though.
Yeah.
We would do things like, we'd try to do like proper songs, you know, serious songs, but it was almost like we were, by accident, we're trying to do normal songs about normal things, but because John was such a conceptually strange man, with his lyrics, it was a bit like being in a very bad Frank Zappa band,
right,
with no chops. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it was just
like
these teenagers who couldn't really play very well. But we were doing these ridiculous, like I say, songs about ferry strikes or you know, bad porn films. You know, we wrote a song called Pleasure Shot once. It was utterly ridiculous.
What was it about?
It was literally about a film that somebody had seen, not me, I hasten to add, that was called Pleasure Shot. It was based in a library. And essentially, as you can imagine, what happens, people are removing books from the shelves and then there's a gap, but then you can see people having sex.
Right.
It's utterly ridiculous.
Yeah, wow.
And so songs like that. And then, you know, this landmark Miners Arms gig, I remember, we decided we were going to do a contemporary cover version of MC Hammer's...
Can't Touch This?
Can't Touch This. But, you know, our singer's just improvising lyrics about living in Lee. We got a very strong cult following of 30 to 40 people, you know. And still to this day, we put on gigs every now and again. Like every five or 6 years, we'll put on a gig, Lee Library or somewhere like that. And the last time we did it, I just thought, you can't really ask people to get, of our age, who've got children, to come out and watch our band play songs about ferry strikes and a dragon called Bloodspike without sweetening the deal. So we just bought a load of wine.
Yeah.
It was like a free booze night, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a phenomenal celebration of life.
Yeah,
I would say.
Yeah.
It was just everybody with like that sort of cheap, you know, it's like
red
cheap
teeth.
Red wine publishing, yeah. Red wine, you know. So
yeah.
Red teeth, yeah, everybody smashed.
Yeah.
Thinking by the last song that they were watching, like a Led Zeppelin concert.
Somewhere between like an Asda ad and a Rembrandt. Do you know what I mean?
I can really see it.
Yeah. I love those, like, because my uncle was in bands and all my cousins have been in bands.
Ah.
So I've been to so many of those gigs where my favourite ever, my uncle was in a band called The Truth and the Happy Endings.
Oh, I like that.
And he'd self-injected Tramadol. And it was, you remember when the Mayan calendar, you remember the 12-12-12?
Yeah,
end of the world.
Yeah.
So he was dealing, my uncle, it was meant to be the end of the world of the yesterday. No one fucking told me. And then was singing, we gotta get out of this world. And it was so brilliant. Like those gigs where, you know, because they're decent, they're pretty tight, you know, they're all good singers. But like you say, there's 40 people there. And it's just it's a bit of a happening.
Yeah.
And it's just this, it's a cozy bit of everything and nothing.
It's
Do you
like,
know what I mean?
It's a bit like a performance art thing, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
When you get really, bands like that, like your uncle, what are they called? The Truth and
the Truth and the Happy Endings.
Fucking great.
It's a great name, eh?
It reminds me, I always talk about my mate Banksy, who was also in Mosque, but then he branched out, a bit like George Harrison after the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And he became like an art, like an art terrorist in Hull, essentially. No, he wasn't actually blowing things up. And him and his mate, Bruce, formed a band called Santa's Bugger Boys.
Oh, brilliant.
And they...
Absolutely brilliant.
They were just... It was literally... They were put on like almost a gig a week at the Adelphi. They were like a sort of house band. And throughout 1999, they decided they were going to put out an album a week.
Wow.
Which they did.
You know, like they were sort of deliberately on the edge of offensive, you know.
Yeah.
One of their albums was called 1K Computer. It had a picture of a ZX81 on the front cover, which I thought was genius. There was an album called 20 Nazi Golden Greats, I seem to remember. You know, so they were trying to push the envelope.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It was just ridiculous. Like people with tubas on stage, people dressed as Spider-Man. Brilliant. You know, that's I love that. It's my cosy place.
And it's sort of like art for art's sake. There's no sort of grand plan. Do you know what I mean? Like when they were writing 20 Nazi classics, they weren't thinking one of these is going to be the one. Do you know what I mean? But there's no, people like that don't have a hint of that horrible phrase, this could go viral. Yes. Do you know what I mean? They're just literally, I love people like that.
Yeah. I wish they'd get back together.
Have you still got the guitar?
No. I'm regretful, you know. Yeah. I would love to have kept it. I mean, my wife would disagree. Where the fuck are we going to put it?
Yeah.
She would rightly say.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is that. I've got a terrible, terrible memory. I always talk about this. But I can still remember the smell of certain guitars that I bought from, like, 32 years ago.
Well, memory and smell is interlinked, isn't it? Because they reckon that's one of the best ways, if you're revising and you're struggling with GCSEs, if you had, like, a little whiff of lavender whilst you're trying to figure out algebra, if you're in the middle of your exam and you sniff the lavender, it helps your brain reconnect.
You know what? There's numerous reasons why I'm glad I'm here, but I'm especially glad that I'm here for that, because my eldest is doing his GCSEs at the minute, and yesterday he was like, I need some tips on revision, you know. I was like,
there you go.
Wasn't expecting to get one from you.
Fucking exactly. This is what I mean.
I mean, the smell might have to be sweaty socks or something.
Stick your finger up your ass and smell it.
But here's a question. While we're here, on that note, was that anyone else's tester as to whether or not they had COVID?
Finger up the arse.
Yeah. That was my thing. I just pop my finger and just go,
No,
I'm fine, actually. And actually, I'm not fine. But
that was
it's just a cough. It's just a cough. I'm cool. I'm fine.
That's awesome.
I'm no danger. No, that wasn't. Okay.
That is just you. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah,
well, no, apparently that is a tip. And I sort of get that, because you could smell a guitar and I guarantee you'd be back to like 1998 or whatever.
It's like, I can't describe. It's like, if you're into, I'm into all the great stuff. You know, if you're into pubs, you know, that unmistakable smell of an old person's pub, you know, it's just the right amount of spilled beer, dry roasted peanuts. Maybe there's a whippet in the corner. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's some amalgamation which says to you, through your olfactory senses, I am in a relaxing place.
Yes.
And it's the same with a guitar, you know. So it's like there's a bit of sawdust probably in there somewhere. Yeah. You know, they've got velvety cases. It's very sensuous.
Yes. It's really funny that, isn't it? Because guitars, I would say by a stretch, are the most sensual of instruments. But also, they're the ones that always get, like, no one's ever fucked up a recorder. Or like, in the like, do you know what I mean? I doubt a clarinet player is just, do you know what I mean? Somebody's taken a chainsaw to a double bass. But it's so weird, isn't it? That they're so desired. And yet, like, no one has been knocked about more than guitars, given their beauty and the place that they have for musicians.
That's a really good point.
But unfortunately, they're the battered wives of... But they are, do you know what I mean? This is the truth.
It's true, man.
They get an abuse they don't deserve.
Yeah.
No one's fucked up a kazoo. No one's backhanded a tambourine. It's just...
I love that.
But it's odd though, isn't it? Like, but what is it? Like, there's something really dark and weird going on with smashing up guitars, I think.
It's sacrificial.
That's what it is.
It's literally sacrifice. It is a sacrifice to the gods, is what that is.
Because I love you so much.
Yeah.
I hate you so much.
It's like the, you know, this runs in my blood, this shit. You know, like Hendrix, Zeppelin, all that 60s, 70s stuff. But the footage of Hendrix at Monterey when he smashes the Strat up and then he sets the fucker on fire is unbelievably, it's kind of very moving to me for some reason.
Yeah,
because it is... I don't know what it's saying.
It's given all that pleasure and maybe it's that I've given all that pleasure and now that moment that we've had can never exist again because I'm going to burn it.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's finished now. That's it. But you were here for it, you know. It's beautiful.
But you don't get to do that if you're in an office. If you torture a printer, you've lost your job. Do you know what I mean? Like, no one's ever going, right on, Derek. Do you know what I mean? It's just, try to put a bandana on and you fucking spin a chair, you're done. So interesting. What's next?
Right, let's have a look. Well, this follows on in a sense. This is a triple A pass, backstage pass.
Yeah.
Okay, to a Foo Fighters concert in Croatia in 2019.
Okay,
and I've chosen that because that's very redolent of a very special few days, for a lot of reasons. But I wanted to take my elder boys, just the three of us, on a bit of a lads jaunt, you know.
Oh, nice.
And I don't do it often enough at all, but I you know, every so often I like to do it. And it just so happens that, because I used to work at BBC Radio 6 Music, like mm-hmm, you did, mm-hmm. You work up quite a decent sort of contact list, don't you? You know, you get to be friends with quite a lot of people in that industry. There's a wonderful chap called Russell who has been working with Dave, Diamond Dave Grove, since the Nirvana days, you know.
Oh, really?
He's an unbelievably cool dude, Russell. Very kind. And he was like, you know, if you ever want to go anywhere, just let us know. So so they were playing in Croatia, and it was just before the eldest was finishing primary school and stuff. So I just booked a few days out there, just the three of us. And that's perilous, right? Because I am adult ADHD. Yes, I'm going to mention it again, but I'm not going to lay heavy on it. You can park that information now you've heard it.
Mm-hmm. And you probably won't know where you've parked it.
It's true.
Okay, yeah, I'm sure. Geez, where's me ADHD? Just going around with a key. Blip, blip.
I didn't know it was that easy to get rid of. We just left it in a park.
Not got that's it the irony, isn't it?
Yeah.
For an innately forgetful people, ADHD, they always remember that they got it.
Yeah, oh yeah, you know, forever. But, you know, me taking two dependents, young dependents, abroad on my own, fraught with danger, managed to get us there. Nobody died. Booked in this really weird hotel in Croatia, which was kind of half, you know, if you've ever been in those places where it's half quite nice, half horrible. And it was like a complex.
Yeah.
But it did have loads of, like, amazing water sports stuff and everything. So through the day, it was brilliant. We were just bouncing around on inflatables and having a great time. And but the build-up was towards this gig, you know. And it was at the Pula Arena in Croatia, which is a 2,000-year-old gladiatorial Roman arena.
Wow.
Right? It's unbelievably beautiful. And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, I'm just not that well-travelled, actually. You know, you're not talking to Palin here. You know, it took my breath away. I'd never seen anything quite like it.
Mm.
And it was a really, really great experience. We were there. We watched the gig. The lads were, at that time, it was before they'd sort of really developed. You know, now they're into loads of stuff that I don't understand, you know, because that's what kids are supposed to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then they were like, dad rock, brilliant.
And it was all shared and it was a moment.
It was. Exactly. I mean, we probably won't get back to that point culturally until they're in the 30s or something. You know?
Right.
So it's a really nice end of that first period of it. So we're all digging the gig. And then Russell comes out to find us, took us backstage, right?
Wow.
And
did you know that was going to happen?
No. Oof. I sort of had a, you know, I thought, but
you didn't want to tell them in case. Yeah, got you.
Absolutely. Certainly wasn't sure it would happen. There we go. Just as the last song is playing and we're like walking down the side of the fucking stage, which is kind of mind blowing anyway. And I've met a lot of rock stars. I've interviewed a lot of people, you know, I've watched from the side of the stage. I've jammed with, you know, Scott Gunn from Thin Lizzy. It's a dad rock special, guys.
Yeah.
So I'm not that phased about this shit, right? But we do go backstage and the lads are kind of like, they've never really done anything like a high end backstage before, you know? And they've made this encampment in this arena. You know?
And how old were they at this stage, the kids?
So Arthur would have been 11 and Wolf would have been like 8, okay, something like that.
So this is just mind-blowing.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
First time this kind of thing's happened. And so Arthur's taking a picture of Pat, the guitarist. You know, can I get a selfie? You know, it's all very exciting. And I'm chatting to Russell, having a quick drink. And then all of a sudden, Arthur, the eldest, is like pulling on my sleeve. He's like, look over there, Dad. And we look over and Wilf's just chatting to Dave Grohl. chat. Yeah, I play the guitar and stuff. Because Wilf had the presence of mind to put his Nirvana t-shirt on, you see. And Dave had just seen him and just gone, pretty cool t-shirt. And then he just starts having a fucking chat with him because that's what Dave's like, you know.
Yeah, and then Dave's
like, so you're the dad, huh? And I'm like, yes, Dave, I'm the dad. And then he held court for a bit. He was like, so what you got to do? So who plays the guitar and who plays the drums? Okay, first you got to listen to AC/DC. If you're the guitar player, you got to learn to play the drums. If you're the drummer, you got to learn to play the guitar. Okay, we got that and all this shit. You know, it's amazing. And they were just like, yeah, Dave, yeah, brilliant, fucking great.
But also, that's to put that into perspective, he's just done an arena gig, a stadium gig, and then throughout no other reason other than the kindness of his heart, he's seen a kid with a t-shirt and then he's given them a cherry on top of
a thousand
cherries. It's beautiful stuff like
that. I think that. Like, how generous, because it's incredible because once you're that at that level, time's the only fucking thing that matters to you, you've got more money than Croesus, you know, not that your time's the thing you're always protecting, but like you say, he's happy to do that, and it was a lovely thing. And then it got even weirder because during the gig, him and Taylor, sadly departed drummer Taylor, would start singing, and they were talking about playing level 42 songs and stuff, right? And I was saying to Russell, I'm really good mates with Mark King, you know, from level 42. Anyway, cut to us leaving the arena, and I hear from behind, Sean, stop. And it's Taylor Hawkins chasing me down the fucking runway. You know Mark King from level 42? I was like, yeah. I'm a fucking huge fan, man.
Wow.
He's like, and then we start talking about that for 10 minutes. He's like, I don't suppose you could put me in contact with him, could you? And so then I hooked these two up, you know.
Wow.
And thus blooms this lovely rock star friendship, you know. But just that, I don't know, just humble guys doing something absolutely remarkable. But like you say, being unaffected by it. But that was why I put that in, because it's emblematic of moments with your kids in particular when it's, you know, you're really on a level, you know.
Yeah.
As you know, we've all been teenagers, and as you move through the gears and you get to that part of your life, you can sometimes drift away from your parents. Are fucking annoying, aren't they, for a long time.
Yeah, but I guess the very fact is that if they're listening to the radio and they hear a Foo Fighters song, they're going to be transported back.
Yeah.
Like Lambda and a GCSE. To that moment of like, oh God, remember that? We had that day, and bloody hell. And I met him, I did Jonathan Ross, and Reese Witherspoon was also on. And it was like the first time I'd done a big telly thing. I was like 27. And they were chatting backstage, because it turns out Dave Grohl's kids went to the same school as Reese Witherspoon's kids. And I think the maths teacher had just left, and they were like, oh, it's a bit of a shame because he's a really great maths teacher. And I'm kind of listening to this going, this is just crazy, and you know, real imposter syndrome. Yeah. And they're like Oscar winner, rock star, chatting about the teacher and the school run. And then Gordon Ramsay was the other guest, and he was called out first. And Jonathan Ross and Gordon Ramsay had about 30 poppadoms on top of each other horizontally, and they were seeing who could smash the poppadoms quickest. And Dave Grohl leans over to young, scared me and goes, what time does this show go out? And I said, oh, it goes out at 10:45. And he was like, yeah, you'd have to be pretty tired to watch this. Kind of incredible moment. As Ramsay and Ross are smashing. But it was, again, he clearly is just one of those blokes that has, he's just a people person, isn't he? But he could obviously sense, oh, that young blonde kid looks a bit worried. I'll have a chat with him.
That's exactly it.
Do you know what I mean? And it kind of just put me at rest, and we had a bit of a laugh together.
I love that. You'd have to be pretty tight. He's quite insightful as well, isn't he? You know, but that's it. It's like emotional support rock star, you know, like an emotional support dog. That's the way I always think of Dave. He's just like you say, there are some people in this world, they don't have to be rock stars, who are just, they just charge your battery up a little bit, don't they?
Yeah.
It's like you're just plugging in for a little boost, you know, and he's one of those.
Yeah, he is. What's next?
Let's have a look. It is, oh, well, I mean, this is conceptually stretching a little. I want to put the Lake District in the box, if that's all right.
Oh, lovely.
Oh, that's got a moan from you.
Wonderful.
Would you agree?
Wonderful you agree? Place.
What is it about the Lake District?
It's like, it's a little bit like having New Zealand up the M6. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like all the, that's a lot of the best bits.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But just, whoop, there you go. Junction 36, hour and a half. It's like being in, you know, sort of on Mount Cook or something. Yeah. It's fucking unbelievable. And also, it's tied in to me with some of the greatest ever times. And it goes back, funnily enough, to like when I got my first guitar, 1987. Everybody remembers that now. But that same year, we went on a fourth year, as we would call it then. I was 14.
Yeah, yeah.
And we went on a sort of geography field trip. And it was just fucking great. It was a real freedom thing, you know. We had our geography teachers were hilarious. They were just pissheads. Mr. Broxholm and Mr. Mitchell. Were your geography teachers pissheads? Yeah,
one guy used to go into the like stationery cupboard, and like we all knew he was just having a slug of something. But you know what I mean?
Just to get through.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he must be so fucking boring teaching GCSE.
I've got to do the water cycle again.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? There's three different types of rock. I'll be back in a minute.
Yeah.
But you can literally hear him.
And you don't blame him. You know, if you were a parent, you'd be like, fucking hell, mate. Don't worry about it. Knock yourself out.
So you're 14. You've got these alcoholics looking after you.
Yeah.
And what happened?
It was awesome because... And I think it's probably enough time, as you know, 36 years. I don't think anybody could be prosecuted now for this slipshod, you know, sort of teaching. But we, during the day, we'd do our thing. And then in the evening, Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Broxholm would go to the pub and they would drop us off outside the off licence on the way. Then we would go in, the oldest looking person would go in, get a few cans, and then we'd sit on the park, get drunk, try and get off with each other, and then go back to the campsite, to the Ambleside Youth Hostel. It was great. But then, so that was a gateway, a portal again into, adult life, it's great. And then it happened again. We went in sixth form and it was even more amazing. But it's just that me and my friends, we didn't go to the Hacienda, even though it was only 15 years, 15 miles away. We just didn't think to.
Yeah.
We couldn't get any drugs for love nor money. We were desperate to get off our nut, but we couldn't. So instead, we just went into real ale. I remember at one point when we were younger, like trying to smoke Mentos wrappers.
Ooh.
I mean, we were desperate. Tea, you know, people do banana skins, all that shit.
Yeah.
You just need, you've got too much on your hard drive. You're spinning out. You're a fucking teenager. Just somebody give me something to intoxicate me so I don't have to live with my brain for an hour or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm still like that now.
And do you get to go to the Lake District now?
I do, yeah, I do. I go up as often as I can. It's not often enough, but I take the kids up there. They love it. Again, there was a really
awesome...
Are you
hoteling? Are you Airbnb-ing? What are you?
We usually take a hotel, like, because, you know, my kids, we're not very good at camping.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really impractical and... You know, because I'm neurodiverse, which I may have mentioned. I can't remember. But you know, like the idea, we went camping. Actually, I've just had a bit of a PTSD there, Russell, because I think it was 2018. So I was still at Six Music, and unbeknownst to a lot of people, actually, for about 7 or 8 years, I did dabble in stand up. I was very pedestrian, and I quit due to public demand, as I always say, because it was just like, you're not very good. So I stopped. And I had a problem. I
no
had a job anyway.
No one ever says that on the poster. Due to overwhelming public demand, he stopped.
That was true. But then I would do live shows.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a little bit of stand-up in them, but it was like a bit like a bad David Letterman. I did quite a lot of them, actually, live in Langerous in Islington. A lot of them were good.
Yeah.
But this particular time, I was invited to go to Latitude Festival and take the family.
Yeah.
But, I could go for free, but will you do a gig?
Yeah.
Now, the kids were about 8 and 11, something like that. And it was my now wife, because I split up and remarried. She was only quite new on the scene. She didn't know the boys that well at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But she agreed that this is a good idea. We'll all go. And a few of us went, a few friends as well. But honestly, It was the biggest shit show. Like, I couldn't put the fucking tent up, yeah. right? And the kids are running wild and going mad and sort of, boy, I'm bored, Dad, where are the churros? And, you know, when I did finally get my shit together, one of the main sort of poles just snapped.
Yeah, yeah.
And luckily somebody came along and sort of helped us patch it up together. And in this kind of maelstrom, mental maelstrom of panic and trying to look after the kids, worrying about what my wife was thinking, because it was a really weird experience for her, I then had to excuse myself and go and do a fucking gig.
Right, in the middle of all that. I mean, as far as prep goes, that is not great.
It's not exactly, you know...
If you've been defeated by a tent, and then you have to go into a big tent full of people.
It was so symbolic, yeah. It was like, you can't even erect this tent. It was one of the most horrible experiences of my life, because I was woefully underprepared. I remember being backstage before, and it only just dawned on me. It was like one of those nightmares, which I have quite regularly. I have not prepared for this, and I don't know what I'm going to do.
But festival gigs, doing stand-up, there's something else, because I've seen good people taken down by those. Yeah, because everything has to be back of the room.
Yeah, that's right.
They are like these, you've got to summon everything you've got.
Yeah. And you've got to be strong, because people will walk in and out. You can't let it bother you.
Absolutely.
You've got to do greatest hits if you've got greatest hits. You've got to get it right. It's a bit like playing Glastonbury, right? But it was awful. It was absolutely one of the worst experiences of my life.
And did your then girlfriend, now wife, see you do this?
Luckily, no, because she was too busy sort of cleaning up all kinds of issues with the kids. You know, when I finally came back to her, she was like saucer-eyed, you know. I can't fucking believe we're doing this. This is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah.
But it was a sort of trial by fire.
Yeah.
And I think that obviously now she regrets marrying me, but she's fucking stuck with it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know,
well, those were the vows.
I've written these. Yeah. But the lakes is like, that's the opposite. That's the ultimate happy place. It's like, I'm not very suggestible. I'm not good at being hypnotized, because I'm not good at visioning things and stuff. But if anybody ever says, I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to go to your happy place, it's like, you know, that's on top of Helvell in a summer, looking down a valley with a bag full of sandwiches, you know, amazing.
Because I struggle with views, and it drives my wife insane. But like, I can look at a view and go, yep, cool, got it done.
Right, okay.
Like, and then have to, but I'm more into, what, did you hear that? That bloke said that. And but when it's like, that is pretty, look at that. Notice that is pretty. I can't hear, well, yeah, obviously it's pretty.
Yeah, okay.
But fine, I've done it now.
It's very interesting, but actually.
It frustrates me, because I can do it in a second.
And then it's banked almost. It's like you've ticked it off.
Yep.
It's like,
yep, that's what
I get that's
what that looks like. It's not going to get any better or worse. But that's it. Like, but do you know what I mean? Like, it's maddening to anyone else. But yeah, I just really, it's so annoying that I can't sit in there. Like, if I were looking at like a Colosseum, I go, yep, that's what that looks like. Cool. In there, fine.
That's very interesting. Because there are so many theories about it, aren't there, which I agree with, which is like the reason that most people feel, because they do, if you look at, you know, sometimes you've got this place in Scotland, and you know, if you look at the sea and the mountains and stuff, it's some kind of ancient wiring, and your brain, your lizard brain is saying, there is food here. We can relax.
Right,
and that's
right.
One of the reasons, you know.
Okay.
Or if you hear the sea, obviously that's a bit ASMR, isn't it? And it's a bit hypnotizing and stuff like that. But that's interesting that you can clock it and park it, and then, all right, fine, I'm done with it now.
Yeah.
That is very interesting. But are you more an auditory person? In all other things, I'm auditory. I'm not very good at visual. I'm really good with, I can hear and concentrate that way. That's why I close my eyes a lot when I talk. But I do love a view.
But yeah, I'm a real sucker for phrases and people. So my dad's brother used to have these kind of mental parties when we were kids. It was like being in a Pogue song. And like these kind of, are they uncles? Are they just old men? Would just kind of come up. And I can remember conversations with them and really going, this is, I'm really enjoying it. This is a view I could look at. This kind of, I could spend hours in that.
Yeah, okay.
Whereas... I don't know. Looking at a mountain, I'm like,
yeah, it's a mountain.
Yeah. It's kind of, whereas I can remember my uncle's got a friend called Cuddly Bob, and him telling me this story about the time he got drunk and went home, and then his wife rang him up the next day when he was at work at the factory, and she was sort of saying, do you remember what happened last night? And he's like, oh God. And he's telling me, I'm like 11. And she's rang me up and she's like, do you remember last night? And I'm like, no, darling, I don't remember last night. She was like, you came in and you asked for sex. Oh God, I've asked her for sex. And then you turned around and said, can I have a cheese sandwich? And guess what? I didn't fucking get either. And I'm 11 and sort of just lost in this kind of like conversation of just this adult telling me that basically last night he tried to bang his wife and he didn't, and he didn't get a sandwich. And I just remember, like, I got so much from that, that I wouldn't get from a mountain.
Are you a kind of an observer as well? Are you one of those people, like a rider who might go to New York just to sort of sit in a cafe? Do you do any of that?
I would rather walk through a city than I would...
look at a bloody mountain.
Yeah.
But that's interesting, because that feels a little bit like a version of what we're saying about the lizard brain. We will be, there's food here. That's food to you, because it's like he's charging up that you'll probably end up getting a gag out of that somewhere, won't you? As long as you put it on the hard drive, something will come out.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think maybe that is what it is, actually. What's next? Let's move from the Lake District. Where are we going on this journey?
Well, again, this is a stretch conceptually, but I do find it adorable when kids mangle words. I just love it. I've not got many examples because, as I've already established, I'm fucking terrible. My memory's awful. I do write things down that they say sometimes because you got to, for that reason. But I just love it. And I've been bollocked a lot over the years for... lightly bollocked, you know, for not correcting kids, you know. I just find it really fun and really funny, you know. And I'm like, oh, say that again. And his wife's like, don't, you've got to tell her how to do it, say it properly. And it's like, oh, do I? Because it's much more fun when, you know, because my youngest, just as we don't have to alight long on this, but like, you know, it's just little things like, she says thunder instead of thunder, right? Yeah. And I suppose it's the accompanying facial expression, because you know, to a what she would have been then, a 2 or 3 year old, thunder's fucking scary, right?
Yeah.
So you know, the sort of the head goes down between the shoulders, and the sort of my youngest looks like me only when she's worried. You know, she's got all my worried expressions. Yeah, so if there's ever thunder, she starts looking like thunder. You know, I just love that. Or like Wilf, my middle kid, we went to watch Thor Ragnarok. You know. And it was Thor Wagnarok. And it used to floor me every fucking time. Yeah, I don't know why, you know. I still say it to him, and obviously he absolutely despises it. It's like, piss off, Dad. You embarrassing man. But that I love. I mean, I could have that all day, put it on a tape, and it would help send me to sleep, you know. I just find that amusing.
I wonder what that is. Do you reckon it's like, presumably it is that thing where if your kids are mispronouncing words, you know that this isn't forever.
Yeah.
And that it's just the kind of silly enjoyment of the moment of just kind of going, God, there's a time where they'll know exactly how to pronounce all these words.
That's
but it. But for now.
But that's it. All of these things, it's a bit like the AAA pass. It's maybe it's because as the older kids get to that age that we remember probably so well, where they're sort of about to go, aren't they? You know, not yet, but soon, you know. And it's like, it feels like there's a door closing, I think, to the parent sometimes. A lot of my listeners, you know, over the years they'd often email when, you know, the empty nest syndrome, you know. We've just dropped our youngest daughter off at Edinburgh Uni and we're bereft, you know, play us a song. And that, I always knew, even when the kids were tiny, that I would dread that moment, you know. Apart, which is weird because they're a pain in the tits. Obviously, a lot of the time, they're a lot of work, you know, that you're constantly picking up after them, having arguments about stupid shit. But of course, that moment, at the same time, every parent dreads it. So you're right. I think that this daft little thing that we're talking about here is a version of that. When they were so innocent and needy, you know, and thought you were the absolute oracle of everything, which of course now they know I'm fucking not.
Yeah.
So that's probably a lot to do with it. Did you ever say cute things, Russ?
My sister she struggled with the word hedgehog. So it'd be hedgehotch.
Oh,
so it'd be that. And there was a kid at our school called Todd Kindler, my mate, and he'd call it a hoppetal. And yeah, he was destroyed for that.
Do you know what I mean? Like, he never really recovered.
No,
yeah,
no one was cute. No one was like, say hospital again, yeah, you thick prick. Do you know what I mean? It was just... But yeah, I like... It's funny, isn't it? Because it's cute when you're a kid. I remember being on the Paul O'Grady show in between Ross Kemp and Cilla Black.
Bloody hell.
And I know. And I said hyperbole instead of hyperbole. I just took a run at it. Do you know what I mean? And it was like,
yeah.
You, as an adult, when you mispronounce a word, it's like the shame that comes over you. It's like, you know, is it quinoa? Is it? Oh, okay. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, do I know? Like, you've just, again, thanks for the PTSD shot in the arm. When I first...
Everyone's got a word, eh?
Oh. When I first started broadcasting, right, so I had an overnight show. I was still working as a radio copywriter in Wolverhampton, but every Sunday from midnight to 6 a.m. for about 9 months, I presented a show on what was then a London radio station called XFM. 6 fucking hour live show.
Wow. Right?
It was insane in the sense that, of course, you get to 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and you're effectively, it's like you're a Samaritans on the radio, really.
Yeah,
you're
talking
to people who are either very distressed, have issues, perhaps a lot of them, or, you know, maybe they are, big hello to all you truckers out there, you know, lonely people, you know, disenfranchised people. It's quite interesting sociologically. But I'm learning my chops. And there was a band called Finger Thing, I'm going on air going, and that was Finn Gathing there with their song coming out on the 3rd of September. And I saw the office light coming on, like the phone light, and I picked it up, and it was Gordon, one of the other presenters who happened to be listening. It's Finger Thing, mate. It's not Fingaving. It's like,
yeah,
but it's, you know, but you're right. It's a real rug pull that as an adult, isn't it?
But sometimes they're so good. So my friend and the great comedian Roisin Conaty, we were doing the Montreal Comedy Festival, and she was late. So basically, a bunch of you're in a van, and then like international comics, you're all doing various gigs in Montreal. You go down the bottom, and then you go to your gigs, and Roisin was late, and the guy was doing like a roll call. Go, we got everyone here. I'm looking for Roisin. Where's Roisin? And Roisin sounds like this kind of like filthy sort of American comic. Yeah. Hey, I only wear blue. Do you know what I mean? And now Roche is known as Roisin.
That's awesome.
Because it's such a great nickname. Yeah, yeah. So me and Greg Davies still call her Roy. What, Roy?
Roisin.
But Roisin, it's like... It's kind of, that's Carolina Hearn levels. You can sort of see that character. Do you know what I mean? You can visually.
All right.
Yeah, exactly.
Bit of Bernard Manning in there.
Yeah, fucking hell, Bryce. Yeah. Beautiful, man.
Love that.
What's next? I think this might be is this the final one?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. This has been lovely.
Should have some kind of drum roll for this. Okay, right. Well, this is a bit easier to contain. The last two were a bit conceptual. This is a box of cassette tapes. Do you remember those, kids?
I do, man. Yeah,
you must remember cassette tapes.
The first ever cassette tape that I bought was SL2 on a Ragga Tip. Do you remember that song? I remember listening to that on my paper round. Loved it.
I listened to the whole of the first Dire Straits album on my Lee Journal round on Thursday afternoons.
Yeah.
It was exactly as long as the album.
And the peril. Do you remember the peril of a cassette tape that you adored when it caught in the radio?
Oh, the
and
horror.
And then you just had to try and just get it back and then pencil it back. And it was just that thing of going... I need this. And then it was sort of flipped and you're like, fuck.
Yeah. Is there a shop I can take this to
and
get
you
it fixed?
To pull it all out and then somehow try and just smooth it down.
Kids will never understand the pain. And it's like that box containing cassettes. It actually exists. I just don't know where it fucking is. Again, neurodiverse. But I even bought a tape converter so I could convert to digital, you know. because I phoned a few. Like, it's got
what is it, and what that converts it to, like CD?
You know, just a file, a digital file. You can have it on your computer.
Oh,
you
like a hard drive.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, amazing.
It's really good. So I did find some early broadcasts, right, and as well as things like, you know, like me and our arms. My eldest son always jokes, you never had any fucking friends, did you? Just you and our arms, wasn't it? Did you have any friends at all? Were you that unpopular? I was like, yeah, yeah. But Wham's Fantastic on one side and Michael Jackson's Thriller on the other.
Ooh.
I mean, 1982 super hits, you know, that got worn thin, you know, yeah, all the way see-through. But yeah, some of the early attempts at broadcasting.
Oh, of yourself?
Of me doing, trying to be a radio presenter is kind of like, is fecund territory, you know. There's a lot of accidental and shameful and embarrassing and terrible stuff on like Fingathing, for instance. But like, really, the other thing I find quite fascinating about it is how objectionable a lot of the jokes that I made, I find now, you know, like things that I wouldn't joke about now, or sort of meanness sometimes about some public figures. I listen, it's like me listening to somebody else and going, why the fucking hell do you make that joke about Pete Doherty? That was a bit cruel.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I know, funny enough, we were talking about this earlier where it's sort of, I don't know whether that's an age thing. I don't know whether that's being able to play your instrument, whatever it may be, whether it's comedy or DJ or whatever, or journalist, play it a little bit better, that you suddenly, not suddenly, but you gradually go for less easier fruit. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And I remember watching that, the Amy Winehouse documentary, and it's when Graham Norton did a joke about her and Frankie Boyle did a joke. And you just go, God, I remember that era, Mock the Week, where the jokes were, it was low-hanging fruit. Yeah. It was like Amy Winehouse or kind of Pete Doherty or Wayne Rooney or whatever it may be. And just going, oh, that'll do. And it's that, oh, that'll do syndrome.
You're right, because in a funny way, you do need a target that everybody will sort of get.
Yeah.
So you can understand why comics and humorists like myself, he's called himself a fucking humorist, Gene. Have you heard this prick?
Sit down, Gene.
But I can understand why.
You've overcooked these eggs. The older you get, I guess, you're less, I don't know, you've got less sneer in you, maybe. And you've got, I don't know, it's so much funnier to mock yourself.
Yeah.
And then through that, like you talking about struggling with a tent, I get that. Yeah. Everyone gets that. That's, and it's it. Kind of, you can be, I don't know, it's just, it's a more enjoyable laugh. Yeah. The experience is better rather than pulling us out of it and just kind of going, I tell you, I'm trying to think, like, Gloria Honeyford can fuck off. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, all right, can't you?
I've done a few Honeyfords.
Like, well, no, but do you know what I mean? But it's that, it's always a shortcut, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
But also, it's when you're young and you just, that'll do.
Yeah.
Will that keep the ball in the air?
Yeah. It's a panic to it.
Well, sneer is a currency when you're a kid, because it's a lot harder and it's braver to say things that you like.
Yeah.
Whereas it's really easy to say, oh, that can fuck off, or, oh, that's crap, that's shit. Do you know what I mean? And then gradually you get the confidence to say, I quite like this thing. Does anyone else?
That's exactly it. And it's a lovely thing. The universality that you're trying to find as a comedian, is it can be such a lovely thing, can't it? When you hit on the right thing. And obviously it always comes down to punching up or down to me. And I still don't think I still think that's something that's applicable and needs to be applied. And I always try and inculcate that in my kids or people coming up, you know. It's like, don't, you know, try always to make sure that if you have got a target for your comedy, even if it's a concept or whatever, that you, like, you're not seen as sneery, that you're not looking down on somebody, you know. I mean, I will have a pop at, you know, the fact that David Cameron's mouth is so small. I mean, I keep saying that. I'm obsessed with it at the moment. You know, it's literally like a buttonhole.
Go as well, Damian Lewis has got a small mouth.
Oh,
as
really?
Well.
I'm going to have to look that one up.
Check it.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's, and he plays a lot of shouty characters.
Yeah, but it's a stretch for him, literally.
It is, but it's like a tent that won't open. Like, as in, you know, when you're just trying to get out of the bottom bit, you probably do from your latitude debacle. Yes.
Oh, the horror. What we try to do now, like, for instance, like, we do this daily podcast, and when people ask me what it's about, it's a struggle, because it's about everything and nothing, right? It's about, It's a bit like what a radio show is sometimes, where you're just talking. You know, you've just got the feedback from the listeners, and sometimes you've got a guest or whatever. But really, all I'm trying to create ever is a bit of safe harbor, is a place, a bit of a cheers bar, a bit of a feeling of reassurance. You know, because I think the world's bloody harsh. You know, especially now.
I think that's clearly the secret of your podcast and things like, you know, Paul Whitehouse and Bob Mortimer Fisher. Yeah. Because that's not the interesting thing about that. It's not a funny show, but it is. There's not a lot of comedy in it, but what there is, there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a safety,
yes.
There's a friendship, there's a conviviality to it. It's just, like you say, it's a safe port of friendship.
Yeah.
And we all get to act out our friendships. So you can sort of, if you're, you know, my mother-in-law can watch it and really enjoy it, and she's... You know, it's safe. No one's getting hurt.
Yeah, there's no target apart from the fish.
The fish
are the only target.
But the fish are getting let back.
Yeah, they are. But that's it. I did a little thing.
A warm fire for the soul.
That's it. Or you know, in my case, the arsehole. But that, you know, when I did my last radio show, I did a bit of a. You know, you have to. It's sort of de rigueur to do a last link. You know, you've got to try and talk to your listeners. Because you're kind of leaving them in a sense, you know. You'll find them again, but it's a very emotional thing. It was unbelievably emotional. It was like I kind of wrote that, and I don't write anything usually, you know, really.
Yeah.
But I sort of wrote that one out. But the basic point that I was trying to get across was, because it occurred to me while I was trying to put it together, because there's a part of somebody like me that thinks, again, it's a bit of imposter syndrome. You think. Fucking out! It's a fucking radio show. Get over it. It's nothing.
Yeah.
It's not. You're not paramedic. You're not doing anything, and that's true. That is true, but then it's not true at the same time because it's never that. If you're doing something for a long time, especially in a broadcast space, you are creating it with the listeners, and you're doing it together.
Yep.
And it's a collegiate thing, and everybody's bringing something. And so it's a bit. It's more than the sum of its parts, and it is an emotional investment. And we all, you know, that is worth something, you know, and so it sort of made me feel good at the end because I always used to feel like these fucking novelists coming in, rock stars with all these monumental things that will last for generations, and what am I doing a fucking radio show? it's like steam off me piss, but then that made me feel better. You know,
you built the shelf to put those things on.
Yeah,
but that it needs a place. Doesn't it? We don't get to hear those things unless I was talking to somebody the other day about pirate radio, Babatunde Eleshe. It's that interesting thing where he was talking about pirate radio when he was a kid was a voice that he'd not heard, and it activated something in him that felt like he could go on and do something. And it's sort of, I was saying, who were the DJs that played this? Because presumably they were the gatekeepers to Stormzy, Dizzy Rascal, Wiley, all these kind of people. And it's very often you think of all the music that means a lot to me as a kid went through Mark and Lars.
Yeah.
Or went through Sarah Cox. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of, I think DJs don't know how they just become part of the background. They're another friend in the room.
That's
and sometimes
exactly
they're the focal, sometimes the background, but they're always there.
They're part of the tapestry, and it's a lovely thing to be, actually. And you do have to sublimate your ego sometimes a little bit to do that. And I always liken it to my cultural contribution is like dropping a tiny pebble into the lake, you know. Mm. And somebody like a great stand-up, for instance, like yourself, you might work on a show for like 18 fucking months. Maybe people don't really hear from you for a lot of that time.
Yeah.
And then you bring this fucking big boulder to the lake and you hurl it in.
Yeah.
Sploodoosh, you know, or a novelist or whoever. Then that's your contribution. And then you have a lot of quiet time, maybe, if you're lucky. but I'm just this little plink, 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 plink. Drives me fucking crackers, to be honest. I want some passive income, guys. I want to create something that means that I can piss off on holiday for 6 months.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I'm like Jesse in the meth lab. I'm just there. Like, you know what I mean? Just like day in, day out, content, content, content. Say something ribald about this fucking story. It drives me mental. You think it's hard listening to it. You want to try shitting it out every day. It's a nightmare, Russ.
That, I mean, that's if you'd have done that as the final link, people like, hold on, I'm glad this guy. But I know I get that. It's sort of, but then would you? Like, yeah. Would you be happy? That's the thing. It's kind of, there's something about, clearly you found your place.
I think you're unfortunately.
And the grass
right.
is always greener. Yeah, yeah. It's like the idea of like, oh, maybe I should do something every day. Whereas like, I think this is what you do. Like yeah. clearly spending like an hour and a half with you, you're kind of a natterer. You're a yeah. brilliant natterer. Yeah. And weirdly you get to do that as a job,
yeah.
which is mental, isn't it?
Yeah.
But my wife's a doctor, so it's insane
yeah.
that you know, I pay the mortgage given
yeah.
our mutual skill sets. Yeah. And that says a lot about this country.
About society, doesn't it?
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, that I've been paid more to pretend to do the job that she does in a sketch for a telly show than she did for a year.
Our priorities are totally bollocks in this country, aren't they?
Well, that's what makes me laugh. It's like whenever I really struggle with awards dues. I really do. And like every, like at the minute, it's so funny that all these kind of award dues happen and, you know, what you can and can't say at them. And you're like, there's wars going yeah. on, fucking hell. It's, I think that's the skill, isn't it? The skill is to be, you've got to be self-aware to know that what you do is ridiculous.
Yes.
But you also have to remember to give it your all because it matters to some people.
It's really, I'm glad you've said that because it offers some clarity to me, actually, funnily enough. You're right. It's that thing of, like they say, comedy is a very serious business.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. We know we're being dicks, but nonetheless, we're taking it extremely seriously because it's our life, it's our craft, it's what we do.
I remember Chris Martin said something really interesting. He was sort of saying, you know, it takes a lot of courage to say that you're a Coldplay fan.
Yeah.
Because they're, yeah. you know, great big mainstream band yeah. and they're, you can easily be picked apart by your mates if you have the balls to say, I quite like Coldplay. And he was saying that his job is to write music so good that those people can hold their head up.
Yeah.
And I thought there was something to that of going, right, I'll try and put my ego to one side. Yeah. And if they've got the courage to say they like us, let's give them something to be courageous yeah. about. I think that is a mantra.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, no matter how big or small your creative project, your mates that were writing those songs in Hole, their aim was to make something really silly and great and special for the people that were going to watch it. And I think if that is your focus, you can't go far wrong. The time it always gets a bit knackered is when you start writing to a formula or...
Success can fuck things up a bit, yeah, can't it? Because then you take your eye off the ball of that sometimes.
Exactly. Or you're trying to create a thing that, like, I've got to go viral, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. But I think if you kind of follow your nose and try and make your space as great as you can make it, you can't go far wrong. And like what you was just saying about your podcast, the world needs these yeah. little havens where you can just go, right, okay, this is going to be fine.
Yeah.
Great. There's going to be no mudslinging, like it's a silly chat.
That's
about
exactly right.
Wheelie bins,
the minutiae of life is so, that's it. And I did it partially because I needed it.
Yeah,
I needed something like that, and so that's it. At six, because it was unbelievably cool.
Yeah, it was daunting.
Daunting cool.
Yeah, man.
I set my stall out as being, by some distance, the biggest idiot there who knew the least about music.
Yeah.
I was the entry point, you know.
Yeah.
But
you've almost got to say that.
Yeah, you do.
Because everyone else just feels like it looked like the jeans were so tight. They looked like they were sprayed on. Like, it was mad. Who were the two girls? They were brilliant and terrifying. Was it Mairead?
Oh, yeah, the Queens of Noise.
Holy
like
shit.
Your
they
time.
Scared
yeah.
the crap out.
Because they lived it. They lived the life, didn't they?
But I remember them coming up to me and John Richardson, and they sussed us out that we knew shit all about music within, like, seconds. So what are you listening to? And it was like, me and John looked at each other and went, bigger girls. But they were, they fuck. And one of them said to me, and I still to this day don't know whether it was a compliment or not. She went, you look very different to how you look in your photos. And just walked away and left me thinking with that. You know, when you were like, yeah, they were
like high school, isn't it? Sometimes a bit of a pecking order sometimes. But that's it. I went in low. And I think, slight bit of genius to self-aggrandize for a moment. This is how I set up in broadcasting in general. You know more than I do. That's what. That's basically my message to the listener. You teach me, because I don't fucking know what I'm talking about. And they love that. Yeah. Listeners love it because you're giving them the power and a bit of agency. And also, they love taking the piss out of you because you don't know.
I really enjoyed this chat, mate.
Me too.
Absolutely one of my favourites there.
Oh, well, honestly, it doesn't happen all that often, but you've dislodged a few slates on my mental roof there and made me think about stuff.
I like that. It feels like that could be an album from one of your whole boys.
Oh, yeah. That could be the next Mosk album, that. 2025.
The Slate Dislodger.
We have got a song called On the Roof.
Have you?
The Man is on the Roof.
It's not about Charles Bronson, is it?
It's about Rod Hull.
Is it?
No, it's not.
It's
not.
It's really short.
That was great, man.
Thank you.
Absolutely joyous. Ladies and gentlemen, the wonderful Sean Keaveney. Oh, that was brilliant. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. That was Sean Keaveney. His podcast is called The Daily Grind, which is a show with guest comedians. It's about everything and nothing. It's released every day from 5 p.m. on Global. See you next week for more Wonderbox.